Good morning. So last time we started talking more about threads, mentioned the pthreads API and how that worked and ways you could pass things to threads. And then we looked at what happens when threads executed simultaneously. And we had this rather annoying story that, well, even if our assembly seems to make sense, so we've done something that looks like it implements a lock with like loading and storing, which we know happen all at once at least. We don't have like bit by bit storing. That we still got into trouble because turns out that processors are not very nice. And they did this thing in an example last time where they decided, okay, sometimes, you know, even though you're storing Y then loading X, sometimes I'm going to load X a little early because that's faster and usually there's no interference. That was pretty inconvenient. And this means that we're going to rely on special instructions that don't do this. And in fact, we're going to rely on special instructions for other reasons that, if you remember last time, we did this example with leaving notes and such, where we eventually had a solution which worked as a lock, but it wasn't very nice. It was pretty annoying to scale up, like we had it only with two, and it's like not clear how to make it work with more. Each thread was doing a different thing to try to acquire this lock. It's not very convenient, it's a workable solution, and in fact it doesn't even work without special instructions. So I mentioned that processors reorder things, and processors usually aren't even the problem if you're trying to write naive code that does something like that nice lock we showed. So for example, I write my Alice code in C++, and then I compile it, and my compiler helpfully decides, oh, you're reading this note from Bob thing over and over again, so I'm just going to load that into a register, because that saves an instruction later on, and just keep testing that value. So we won't ever notice if Bob happens to write to that value. And so the compilers helpfully made this an actually infinite loop, because the compiler, when it optimizes the rules in C++ and C, the compiler basically assumes, unless it has reason to otherwise, that your code is single-threaded. And in single-threaded code, well, there's nothing which can change note from Bob in that loop, so it doesn't change. And that's what the compiler assumes. That's how it works. But at least, in this case, we're writing the note from Alice on time. Yeah, we have that covered. But let's say we decide, oh, we're going to make the note as a 2 instead of 1 to indicate that Alice was done. Just, you know, a nice convenience feature. Then my compiler says, oh, I'm writing 1 and then I'm writing 2? I can just write 2. Why would I need to write 1? Yeah, that's going to save some time. Save a few instructions, very convenient. So just like the processor got us in a little trouble, the compiler gets us in even more trouble. Like there's much more distance here, and like we're just omitting writes entirely, and it's not even rare. Like this comes up all the time. Like this is like simple attempts to write the most trivial code that does this sort of simple load and store based locks we saw last time. So, fortunately, there are ways of telling both the processor and compiler to knock it off. Stop doing this. When I write to the note from Alice, I want that to actually happen. When I read from note from Bob, I want to actually read from it, not read from it once and then forget it might change. And one thing that happens is the pthreads functions, all the pthreads functions that are supposed to synchronize something, prevent reordering. They both prevent the compiler from assuming that, oh, I can move this store later and combine it with the other one and just only store 2, or from saying, oh, I can just load once. They prevent those optimizations, And they also run these special instructions which prevent the processor from doing weird things like deciding, oh, I'm going to load this value a little before that store, that should be fine. So they have the appropriate magic to make this happen. This includes not just like the pthread mutex lock and unlock, which would be the obvious things that would need this, because when we acquire a lock, we want to make sure that, well, when we release the lock, most importantly, we want to make sure everything that we've done is finished before someone else acquires it. So it includes that, but it also includes other functions you might not think of this way, like pthread create. Like, it's guaranteed that if you do some stuff and then create a thread, that new thread will see that stuff you did. That's very convenient that the compiler and the processor aren't going to have some value you wrote that you want the thread to read not visible. It's guaranteed that that's going to work out. And pthread join, that if the thread, when it's finishing up, writes some values after the join, you can definitely read them. Pthreads will make sure of that. And to make this happen, there are compiler features to do this prevention of reordering. So for example, in GCC, there's a bunch of built-in functions beginning with two underscores in sync or atomic that prevent reordering, including compiler and CPU reordering of, you know, any visible operations like stores. And they also provide other tools for implementing locks, which we'll see later. So there are instructions which help implement locks. And in GCC, rather than writing assembly, you can use some of these functions that are named like this. You could also handwrite assembly code. And if you think about optimizers, like if the compiler sees you calling an assembly function, it probably can't assume that that function does anything in particular. So it has to assume, for example, that that function modifies note from Bob, even if it doesn't. And so it would do the appropriate things of reading note from Bob every time after it calls a function like that. So for example, and we're not going to test you on what these functions are. You'd look them up if you needed to use them. But one of these functions is called atomic thread fence. Fence is so called because all the loads and stores before it can't go through. So they all have to finish before the fence, and anything and if they're started after the fence, they can't leak before and be started early by the processor to save time. So we can do this. And this adds an mfence instruction, which is the special instruction to do that, in addition to making the compiler say, oh, I have to actually access memory every time. So the mfence instruction is this special instruction that prevents reordering, and the compiler is also checking memory every time. So this instruction, as I said, what it does is it makes sure every load and store that's in progress that was started before the fence finishes before it lets you go further, and makes sure no loads and stores are started early. Nothing. If there's a load after the fence, it's going to wait until the fence finishes before it starts. And the reason why we don't just do this all the time, and why processors don't just, you know, processor compilers don't just do this all the time, is it's fairly expensive on a modern processor. So for example, on Skylake, it's like 33 cycles plus any time you have to wait for loads and stores to finish extra. Which, I mean, isn't expensive in the grand scheme of things, but you wouldn't want to be doing this actually every iteration of every loop. Like, that would really start adding up, because this is like several hundred ats. And I note that there's another way to use these built-in functions, which is maybe more explicit, and that there's a store and load, which version of those functions, which work where you say, I want to store this value, and I want it done right now. So it does a store and a fence. And you say, I want to load this value, and I want it done. I really want it loaded. Something else might be writing it, and it does it like directly without skipping. And this version notably doesn't call mfence as much, because it turns out you don't need a fence on x86 to read values that come from other processors. So any questions about reordering? And these functions, I'm just mentioning them, so if you know, if you need to look them up because you need to deal with this stuff for some reason, rather than using like pthread mutex lock, you have a way of doing it. And you know like where to start. So any questions on reordering and so on? Okay. So we have these high-level functions here that do the appropriate synchronization, and we see like that the sort of instructions they're implemented with. What we haven't talked about is, well, how does the hardware actually communicate values? Like, we have this shared memory, and conceptually our model is that, well, multiple processors are connected to the memory, they talk to the same memory. So how does that physically work? And there are multiple ways that hardware is built. To discuss the problems in designing this, and which are going to affect how we implement locks, it turns out, I'm going to use the simplest model, which is a real way processors are commonly built, but it's not the only one, and that's a shared bus. That everyone's connected to a shared line that everyone can see all the messages on, and they tag the messages. So when CPU 1 wants to read from memory 1, it puts memory 1 at the beginning of its message, so CPU 2 knows, oh, this is not for me, I'm going to ignore it. And we have this one big share communication mechanism. This is relatively easy to implement in hardware. You know, it's one wire that everything, well, one set of wires that everything's connected to. And we have some hardware mechanism to deal with contention. So if CPU 1 and CPU 2 want to talk at the same time, we're going to do something in hardware to choose an order in which they talk. That choice is a subject for an electrical engineering class, not this class. But there's some mechanism so only one CPU or memory talks at a time. So as I said, this is not the only mechanism. In particular, this design doesn't work great if the number of CPUs you have is very large. Because then you have one bottleneck where all reads need to go through. Every read to memory goes through this one thing. You'll not be able to do as many reads as you'd like. So with a larger number of processors, this becomes problematic. But this is actually fairly common, especially since CPU here often means a socket. By which I mean the physical package that you put in the motherboard, which might have multiple cores on it. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it actually means a core. So this is how we talk to memory, and everything seems fine here as far as our load and store model. The idea is that when CPU wants to load a value, it goes to memory, reads that value, gets it back. So in our loop where we're checking note from Bob, CPU 1 just goes, okay, let's see what note from Bob says. And ask again, and then says, oh, what's note from Bob now? What's note from Bob now? And just keeps asking memory 1 what it is. And CPU 2, which is maybe running the thing which sets note from Bob, eventually writes to the memory. And after that, CPU 1, when it asks the memory for the value, sees that new value. So that's our, you know, a simple model, and that would work, but this is not actually what we implement. So what component am I missing, which keeps us from actually having things execute that way? Something we learned about in architecture. Processors do to be fast. Why won't we just talk to memory, like, every time in that loop? Yeah. Yeah, so we want to cache. We don't actually want to go to memory every time, because we learned when we talked about caches that that's really slow. So we're not going to do that. So we're going to have caches. And to make the caches fast, they need to be close to the CPUs. So each CPU is going to have its own cache. And this gives us a bit of a problem. So let's say CPU 1 has this address cached here, A300. CPU 2 has this address cached, and CPU 1 decides to write to that, like setting note from Bob to 1. There's a question of, well, that write happens, when do the values get updated? So the question is, when this write happens here, when does CPU2's value get updated? And when does memory get updated? Okay, so you're remembering that we have write back. So ideally, when this write happens, we wouldn't even like to update memory. But this is a problem, because now if CPU2 reads this value, if we do nothing, then it's reading an old value. And things get more confusing if, like, we had three CPUs and two of them were trying to write to the value. And we'd like to provide that idea you saw before, that, you know, loads and stores are atomic, they happen in some order, and it actually works, and we like to do that without sacrificing caching. But caching has this problem that we have to figure out how this write of 101 eventually makes it to CPU2, and how we do this without making it impossible to reason about what our programs do. And we're going to use this trick here to handle the biggest part of the problem, which is that, well, all the processors are already connected to this shared communication line. And let's say we decide to have a write-back cache. Then, when CPU1 writes 101 here, it's going to take 101, it's going to send it to memory. And CPU2 could just say, oh, you're writing to a value I have cached, let me just update that. So this is known as snooping the bus, taking a peek at what's being sent. So because you already receive all the reads and writes to memory, you can take advantage of this to update your caches. So except for the write-back problem, which we'll deal with in a bit, like, this means that we kind of, for free, we can figure out how to keep our cache in sync. As long as we see all the writes, we can learn when the value we have cached is supposed to change by just taking a peek at what's being sent to the memory, even though it's not supposed to be for us. So we'll just use all those messages to clean up bad cache entries. Now, if we're just looking at things which get written already, we do have this problem that if you remember when we talked about caches, we had write-back caches. And we really want to be able to modify values in our cache without going to memory all the time. Because especially for the last level cache, that's pretty slow. So what we're going to do is we're going to send some extra messages, which are going to be kind of like fake memory writes to keep the caches in sync. But we're going to rely on this idea that when something changes in memory, we're going to broadcast it if someone else needs to know it on this bus. So everyone's going to read from this bus and see what values are changing, when do I have to key things up. Now, to do this and support things like write-back, we're going to have a little extra information for each cache block. And this is going to replace the valid and dirty bits. So we're going to keep some extra information, which is going to include whether the cache block is valid or dirty. And each cache is going to store this and update it based on what it hears is going on. When it hears someone writes a value or reads a value, it's going to keep track of it. And each cache is going to have its own state. So for the same cache block, we might have different states for each block. And we're going to just keep them up to date. And I'm going to start with the simplest set of states that are probably useful, and that are these three states. So we have modified. Modified state means the cache has an updated value that might not be in sync with memory. So it has a more up-to-date value than memory. This is our dirty state. We have shared. The cache is only reading, it's not writing the value, and it has the same as memory and others. So there's one common value, everyone has it, but I'm only reading, I'm not writing, and that's why it's okay for me to have it cached. And invalid. So note that a key property here is that the modified state is the only state we're allowed to write in. Yeah. No. So you can think of the modified state as sort of locking the block. That this is sort of acquiring a lock on the block, so we're the only cache who updates it. No one else changes it, so you don't have to worry about any conflicts, anyone getting confused about what the value of that cache block is, because only one processor is going to update it at a time. Because only one processor is going to go to the modified state for that cache block. Everyone else is not going to do that. And this is going to be a state machine. So if you remember your state machines, you have states, you have transitions. And our transitions are based on whether we hear a read or a write, or whether we want to do a read or a write. So for example, let's say I've written the value, I have the value cached, so I've read that value before, and I want to do a write to it. So someone asked me to write it. What that means is that I want to write it, I'm going to go to modified, and to do that, I'm going to send a message on the bus. And the reason I'm going to send a message on the bus is that that property of the shared state I showed you earlier, that it was up to date, is no longer going to be true after I start writing. So I'm going to send a message to inform other people in the shared state. And those people in the shared state are going to hear that there was a write and go to invalid. They're going to remove that item from the cache while I'm changing it because they don't have the right version anymore. So other examples. So if I hear a write while shared, I'm going to change to invalid. And later on, maybe I'll try to read that value. That's okay. When I read the value, I'm going to hear the correct version. And for example, another important example is that if we have it in the modified state and we do a write, we don't need to do anything. You're the only one who has it. Okay, so questions about this so far? I'm going to work through an example. It's a little more concrete. Okay, so let's go through a little example here. So we have some values here. And we're going to be updating our shared A300 value. So first, let's say I want to write 101. With this set of states, I'm going to change from shared to modified. And I'm going to send a message on the bus. I could actually write the new value. But commonly, real implementations of this will just send a message saying, I'm writing this value, but not actually update memory. We'll just send this value is being written just to let other caches know about it. They'll update memory later. And CPU 2 is going to see this and say, oh, that value is being updated. I'm going to go and set my cache block invalid because I no longer have the right version. Then later on, we can say change that 101 to 102. We don't need to do anything yet. We just change it. Later on, if there's a read, we're going to see that read, and we're going to say, oh, sorry, I forgot to send this to memory. Here you go. So later on, if there's a read, we'll know because it's in the modified state that we need to fix it because we have a better version. So this means that when CPU 2 asks, hey, what's this value? Like it's really asking memory, but we're going to, at CPU 1, we're going to hear that message and we're going to say, oh, no, don't listen to memory. I have the real value. And the bus is going to need to have some way to let us do that, to let us respond saying, I'm more important. I have the real value. It's really this, and actually update memory with that value before CPU 2 does its read. And then CPU 2 actually reads the value and gets the right number. So, any questions about this example? Yeah.
Did you go backwards? So how did the modified on the left 102 get changed to shared?
It gets changed to shared because we heard a write read, so we know we're updating memory. So now we know we have the same version as everyone else. And we also have this rule, which is just, you know, this is just a rule, set of rules that says we changed to shared in that case. And these rules is chosen because it keeps things consistent. So other questions? If it's modified and there's a write? So the question is, where would that happen in a real program? Where would I modify a write written value? So a common example is, let's say I have like a temporary string on my stack. That's gonna be in my cache, I'm gonna be modifying it all the time. And maybe some other processor had that same address cached, you know, just because we reused our stack. That would be a common case where that happens. So that, like, a common case for values being modified is that they're not actually shared, but we still need to handle just in case. So that's probably the most common case. Another case where we're gonna have modified values written immediately, written over and over again, is let's say we have, you know, something that's locked, but, you know, we're the only thread that's actually active right now. So we have some shared value, we acquire a lock, we modify that value, we unlock the lock, then we do it again, you know, we might keep modifying a value without writing it back to memory if no other thread happens to be using it, even though they could. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and note that there was this trick here where we needed to broadcast a write when it happened the first time, but not the other times, just to invalidate the other caches. We didn't want them to think, I still have the shared value which is up to date. And to do that, we didn't actually need to send the value we're writing. We could just send a message saying, I'm writing this address, please get rid of it. So I note that we don't get rid of cache replacement and write back. So, you know, eventually we're gonna run out of space in our cache. We're going to need to get rid of values, we still just write them back, which changes our state to invalid from whatever it is. If it's modified, we have to write it back. If it's shared, we don't. So this is, you know, summary of our states here. Modified was the value may be different from memory, not guaranteed. You don't like actually check if we like set it to another value, then set it back. But it may be different from memory, and I'm the only one who have it. This is the property that transition set maintains. And I'm asserting this without proving it. If you wanted to like implement a processor, you probably want to prove it. Shared is the value is the same as memory, and invalid is that I don't have the value, I'm gonna need to ask for it. Okay, so, this is a simple what is called a cache coherency program. It keeps the caches coherent. They agree on what the state of memory is at all times. And if we didn't have that pesky reordering of loads and stores, this would mean that we get exactly the sort of interleaving we expect when we were talking about that note from Alice, note from Bob sort of lock implementation. Because we make sure every value is written to one at a time, we have an order for how every block of the cache is modified, and block of memory is modified. That's the same everywhere. Real processors do something like this, but it's usually a little more complicated. So there's these common extensions. So one thing you might say is, gosh, we're tracking modified, and sometimes we might have a modified value, which like we change back to the original, or we'll learn later on, there are other reasons to have a modified value besides writing. Some variants of this, they add some extra states to track, oh, here's a value that I'm intending to write, but I haven't written yet. It's not, doesn't need to be written back. But I'm the only one who has it in case I want to write it. And that makes it faster because we don't have to invalidate as often. another optimization is that I showed we write the value to memory, and then we read the value from memory to get it between CPUs. An obvious optimization is, well, we have a shared bus. Why do we even go to memory? Let's just ask the cache who has it. And some processors do that. And some systems, when you don't have a shared bus, you might not want to broadcast every time you're writing a cache block to everyone. So they have ways of not broadcasting that to everyone, which requires figuring out who could have this value in their cache. And that obviously requires tracking a lot of information, but it's sometimes worth it, especially if you have a lot of cores. Okay, so this is how we actually keep caches in sync. This is how we have our writes actually be atomic and still do useful things with write-back caches that are fast, so on. This sort of protocol is also really useful because it means that there's something processors can do for us that's really convenient for implementing things like locks, that's sort of just a natural consequence of this way of synchronizing caches. And that is that they can provide atomic read, modify, write operations. So this is going to be one instruction that atomically, so not like that add where we like sometimes got the wrong sum, like atomically, without being interrupted by other processors, like no interleaving, reads a value, modifies it in some way, and writes back the changed value. We're going to do this all at once in a way where no other processors can interrupt us. And the trick here is that the way we're going to implement this is that, remember, that modified state means no one else has a copy. We just get a cache block in the modified state, do our read and modify and write, and as long as we don't let it change to another state, we've done it without anyone else interfering. So it's actually fairly simple for the processor to implement this, these operations. So I'll give an example of the x86 instruction. So this is lock exchange. Yes, there are two words there. This is atomic exchange. So it takes a value from memory, puts it and swaps it with a value in a register, but it does that atomically. So no other processor, so it's not possible. No other CPU can sneak in here. Here. So we're not going to let any other CPU act here. And the way we're going to implement that in the hardware is we're just going to get the cache block into the modified state, do this whole thing, and just make sure it doesn't change to another state. If it does, like, we'll retry or something like that. But because we know it's always in the modified state, we know no one else was even reading the value, they can't possibly have interfered with this. Okay, and this is going to allow us to do an operation known as test and set, which is the most common way of implementing locks. And some processors provide this as a dedicated instruction. In x86, this atomic exchange is the simplest way of doing test and set. So we have this one test and set is we write a fixed new value and read the old value. And we can use this to implement a lock. The idea is we have two possible values we care about. We have taken and not taken. And the idea is we write to mark the lock as taken. Maybe the lock was already taken, we don't care, then we're not changing anything. And because we're doing an atomic exchange, we're reading the old value of the lock. And if the old value was taken, well, we weren't the ones to set it as taken, someone else got the lock. But if it wasn't, then we were the first one to get this lock, so we have the lock, we can do things that no one else will interfere with. So this idea makes sense. So here's a 64-bit x86, what is called a spin lock with that. We're going to use 1 as our taken value, 0 as our not taken value. And so we'll put 1 in EAX, we'll exchange EAX and the place where we're holding the lock, some shared variable. And if EAX was not 0 before, so it was already 1, then we're going to jump back and retry. And we're going to keep doing that until eventually the lock was 0, it wasn't taken, and we can take it. We'll just do that over and over again. And in our release, we're going to do a memory fence to make sure everything we did while the lock was held actually shows up for the other processor that acquires the lock, and then we're going to move a 0 into the lock. So this is called a spin lock because we have this loop here that we just keep running over and over and over again until we can get the lock. And you might complain, that seems really inefficient. It is. We'll have a fix for it later. So questions about this spin lock? Yeah?
Could you explain again what the test instruction is doing?
So this test is, this together is if EAX doesn't equal 0, go to acquire. The test instruction does a bitwise AND and sets the condition codes. This is might be a subtlety that you wouldn't remember from when you learned x86 assembly, and it's not particularly important. But that's if EAX is 0, doesn't equal 0, then go to acquire. Other questions? Yeah.
When does it actually do the write it was trying to do? Because that seemed to be like right after that.
When does it do the write? Which write?
When does it write to the variable it's trying to change?
The lock variable?
Yeah.
When locking? When does it write or when unlocking?
When it acquires the lock.
When it acquires the lock, this exchange unconditionally puts 1 in the lock. Because EAX contains 1, and we're putting 1, exchanging EAX in the lock, so the lock becomes 1, because that's what was in EAX. And EAX becomes the old value of the lock. So we're writing every iteration, but if the lock's already held by someone, our write doesn't change anything. But every time of that loop, we're doing a write. Just sometimes we're writing 1 to something which is already 1. Other questions about this? Okay. So, right. So I showed you some, simple atomic operations. So I mentioned test and set. So some architectures don't have an atomic exchange instruction, but they have a test and set instruction that does the actual 1-0 check. So these are like simple atomic operations, and because we can do pretty much whatever we want while we have the cache block in this modified state, processors sometimes have more complicated ones. So, for example, x86 has compare and swap, which takes an old value, and if the thing is equal to that old value, it writes a specific new value, otherwise it does nothing, and it returns whether it changed the value. So basically, write if it was old value, and tell me if you did that. And x86 also has, for example, fetch and add. So which will add atomically, add to a value, and fetch the old value. And you can use these directly if you're really adventurous or really care about performance for some reason to like do complicated things. So for example, if we have compare and swap, we can append to a linked list. We can say, I'm going to get the last next pointer on the linked list. And sometimes it might be being changed. So I'm going to read that value. And I'm going to find that last pointer. I'm going to use compare and swap to change it from null to my new value. And because I'm using compare and swap, it's going to tell me, was it actually null? And if it was, it will change it and tell me, yep, I changed it. And otherwise, I'm going to have it, it's going to say, well, it wasn't null, I didn't change anything, and I can just try again. Note that there are some assumptions here, some of which are pretty hefty, like people aren't removing things from the list, which make this maybe a little less practical to do than people might like. Because sure, it's nice not to have locks, but it turns out to also be complicated not to have locks. So any questions on what's going on here? This compare and swap operation? Just basically, compare and swap is the name everyone uses. If I was naming it, I'd probably call it compare and maybe write or something like that. Because that's more accurate about what it's doing. Okay. And a common pattern you'll see, and you saw this with our lock, is that you'll try to do some operation over and see if it failed, and then try again. This is commonly how you'll see atomic operations end up being used when you want to do something more complicated. So we saw that with our spin lock. We try to acquire the lock, see if it worked, and if not, we just keep retrying. Saw that with that linked list example. We try to modify the end of the linked list, see if it was actually modified from null, and if not, we keep trying. So with that pattern in mind, if you have compare and swap, I told you about fetch and add. So fetch and add reads a value and then adds to the value atomically. So we know we read the value we just added to and didn't lose an add. How can we implement that with compare and swap? Remembering this try again pattern. Volunteer to give me an outline what it should look like. So this is our atomic operation. So this whole thing we have is going to be an atomic instruction. It's going to happen all at once without other processors interfering. And we're going to have to use that to do fetch and add. And the hint from earlier is that we're going to need a loop. We're going to keep trying something over and over again until it works. No. Yeah.
Would new value be incremented every time in the loop that you call this function?
What do you mean be incremented? So.
Because I'm trying to say is like, variable name and then plus plus.
Yeah.
Like that operation, is that maybe what you're getting here? I'm not really sure.
So new value is going to be assigned to a location we specify. So for fetch and add, we want it to be what we're adding, the value plus being added. So our target is that if no one's interfering, that's one way of thinking about it. So if no one interferes, what we want to do is we want to do compare and swap, the location we're modifying, from the old value of the pointer to the pointer plus what we're adding. So that's what we want to try to do, and we want to do that atomically. That's what the but also read pointer. But this is the update we want to do. So we're going to do this update. But we also want to know what the value, old value was, so we're going to stash the old value somewhere. And we're going to use that instead of reading the pointer a bunch of times, because someone else might be doing this too. So we're going to have value and value plus amount. And this is going to say, if this succeeds, then no one else snuck in there and did another compare and swap or something else. So we're going to say, if this works, then we return value. Otherwise, else we retry. That's our pattern. So we say, I think that I'm going to be returning this value. I'm now going to try to do the update and see if that's actually true. See if I actually added that amount without anyone interfering. And if I did, I'm done. Otherwise, I'm going to try again. And eventually, no one's going to sneak in, you know, in this little window of time here and write the value. And so that gives us this code. If I add the exclamation point, which is that we fetch the value, we try to go from that value to that value plus amount, and if that works, we're done. If not, we keep trying. We fetch a new version of the value because it must have changed, and try again, and eventually we've updated it from old value to old value plus amount without anyone interfering, and we have the value we read while doing that, and we return that. Okay, any questions here? Yeah. Question is, could another program change the value and we add amount to that? Yes. The idea is that if we're using this operation, we better not care exactly when the fetch and add happens, so long as it happens. So long as the value we return is actually was a value that we read and one where we set a new value to that plus amount. But even if that wasn't at the earliest possible opportunity. So, other questions? Okay, so let's go to talk about XV6. So XV6 does something very similar to that spin lock I showed you earlier. This is the actual code they have. So they disable interrupts, we saw that earlier, but they handle multiple cores. They do that exact exchange you saw earlier. This is just written in C code where this is a function which wraps that lock exchange assembly instruction I showed you earlier. And they have this sync synchronize here. This is just to tell the compiler, hey, I want you to keep reordering of loads and stores from happening. Really, don't do it. Okay. So you saw this earlier, same concept. Any questions on this? And the release is similar. We have the synchronize, which generates that memory fence instruction and keeps the compiler from moving a store after the release, because we wouldn't want that to happen when everything actually updated. And then they do this is inline assembly. This turns into a move of zero. So it's basically exactly the lock I showed you earlier. That's actually what's implemented in XV6 plus disabling interrupts. So any questions on this? Okay. If you look at the lock, there's also some debugging stuff. Like some of you have experienced this piece of code going off, which is that it checks if you're acquiring a lock that you already acquired. So they have like some bookkeeping to keep track of that, which is very handy because, you know, acquiring a lock you already acquired otherwise would be very confusing. Okay. So spin locks have two big problems. So one big problem is that they're actually really bad for that shared bus I showed you. And the issue is something you might call ping-ponging. So let's say we have three processors trying to acquire the same lock. CPU 1 has it locked, got it. Everyone else is trying to get it. So they're going to execute that comic exchange instruction. So let's say CPU 2 wants to do that. It's going to say, I want to modify lock. It's going to send a message on the bus saying, I'm going to try to write the lock. And it's going to invalidate everyone else's copy of the lock. Going to cause CPU 1 to write the value, and it's going to get the new locked value. It's going to read that, I swap it with locked, find out it was already locked, and that's too bad. And then CPU 3, which is also trying to acquire the lock, is going to say, oh, I want to modify the lock. So CPU 3 is going to send a message saying, I want to modify the lock too, and it's going to invalidate everyone else's copy, including the one that CPU 2 just got. And this is going to keep happening over and over again. We're just going to flip back and forth between CPU 2 and CPU 3, and they're going to keep sending messages on this bus, which, by the way, is the only way we can read memory, which can be pretty bad for performance. Because CPU 1 is trying to do something, it's trying to read some unrelated memory locations, and now the bus is busy. That's too bad. And it's going to run slower. So this is not ping-ponging, so we have this ping-pong between cache, because everyone's saying, I'm going to modify this value, and move the value back and forth, sending a message each time to say, I want to get the value now, please get rid of it, over and over again. So there's a common solution for this, which is that we're going to do this sort of double checking of the lock thing. So first, we're going to check the lock non-atomically. We're just going to read the lock and see, could we maybe get it? And we're going to have a loop where we check that over and over again. So we have this loop up here where we get the lock non-atomically, and this is just a read, so we're just going to read the value. We're not going to say, I want to write it. Everyone else can still have their copy of it while we're doing this, because we aren't modifying it. We're going to put it in the shared state. We're going to do that over and over again, and then when that happens, we're going to try to actually do the atomic operation that acquires the lock. We're still going to use an atomic operation, so we don't have to worry about anyone sneaking in. We just have this check beforehand, could that atomic operation maybe work? And that check is faster because we don't actually say, hey, I want to be the only one touching the lock right now. While we're waiting, we say, other people can use the lock, it's okay. Only when we say, I'm going to try to get it now, do we say, I want to be the only one touching it. And this turns out to work out a lot better. So here we have it, CPU 1 has it modified, and we just, CPU 2 says, I want to read the lock, and the lock goes into the shared state, CPU 3 does the same thing, and now everyone's just reading from the lock, and in fact, they look in their cache, they say, oh, I have a copy of this value in the shared state, and they don't send any messages, they don't waste everyone's time in validating cache blocks, sending values on the bus over and over again. Yes?
So for the lottery scheduler assignment, do we acquire release the container because we don't want to change or schedule?
So the question is, in the lottery scheduler assignment, you have a lock, why are you acquiring it? It's because you don't want, for example, process states to change while you're scheduling. Okay. So you'll commonly see people doing test and set do this little change. And there's actually a whole large literature on things you can do to make efficient locks. So there's other spin lock designs which work differently that try to avoid all the sorts of issues with how slow communicating between processors is. So, other questions on that? So that's a brief look at like the hardware implementation of locks. Since we talked about cache coherency, there's one sort of side topic related to cache coherency I think is important to go over, and that's what happens when we modify two parts of a cache block in parallel. So typical memory access, you don't access a whole cache block. Cache block's like 64 bytes, you're accessing like 4 bytes. What if another processor is accessing another 4 bytes? The good news is that this cache coherency protocol I showed you means that it's going to work, that you're going to see the right values, because when you write 1 4-byte to the cache block, you're going to get, your processor is going to get that whole cache block, it's going to change it, and then the other processor is going to get the whole cache block after you've updated it and change it. We don't have to worry about having, you know, your write of the cache block overwrite something irrelevant that happens to be nearby in memory. You know, as long as you're writing a different 4 bytes. So that works because the writes happen one at a time to the entire cache block. But this can have performance effects. So here I have some code where I take in a destination address and I just accumulate a sum in that address. I have this function here where I take two parts of an array that are apart by an amount, and I run two sums in parallel going into those two things in the array. So when distance is very small, like 1, they're right next to each other, so they're in the same cache block. And when distance is very large, they're not. So when they're right next to each other, we're writing to different parts of the same cache block over and over. And when it's a fart, we're writing to different cache blocks, so they're actually independent. And just like we saw that ping-ponging with locks, we have that same effect here when they're in the same cache block, even though they're different values. They're different array elements. Even if they're one apart, they're different array elements, but it's the same cache block, and the processor, when it's talking to memory, works in cache blocks, not like inter elements of arrays. And you can see real performance effects from this. So here is the distance I set in bytes. And you can see my system has 64-byte cache blocks. When the values are in the same cache block, it takes a lot longer to do that summation than when they're not, because the two threads are interfering with each other and the different cores are sending the value back and forth over and over again as we add to the sum. And the fix is, if you're writing credit code, try to keep values fall apart. This problem is known as false sharing. So any questions on that? The basic idea is, if you want to have two processors act independently, they better act on different cache blocks. So no questions on this? Okay, so let's get to our last little question of, how do we make locks not do this hideously inefficient thing of running a loop that does nothing for a long time? You know, that in the XV6 spin lock, we just have this loop where we keep running exchange. It's going to keep failing until someone releases the lock, but we keep trying over and over again, and maybe it's going to be a while. You know? What if we were trying to do this to wait for a process which is like doing I/O? That could take a really long time. You know, we're waiting for a key press, for example. And we really like to do something with the CPU instead. We don't want to just be sitting, wasting time, not doing anything useful. So that gives us this idea of mutexes, which is the locks you saw in pthreads. So they still have a lock and a lock operation, but they don't run an infinite loop to wait. Instead, when they need to wait, they're going to give away the CPU. That we're going to go to sleep and run the scheduler. The scheduler is going to run another process, and the unlock operation is going to be more complicated. So with spin locks, our unlock was just set the lock, set that flag to zero, not locked anymore. Here, the unlock operation needs to figure out what thread was waiting and wake it up. So our unlock is a lot more complicated. And you can use spin locks to build mutexes. And I'm going to show you how that works. And the idea is that we're going to have a list of waiting threads, and we need some way to lock that list, right? Because two threads are going to try to add themselves to the list at the same time. The way we're going to lock that is with spin locks, but since we're only updating this list of threads, we don't have to worry that they're like doing IO or something like that. It's just going to be a very brief amount of time where we update this waiting list that we have this inefficient lock. And then we're going to do the more efficient type of waiting where we give up the CPU. So here's our sort of data structure. We have a spin lock, which guards the two things in this mutex. So our mutex has a isItTaken variable and a list of waiting threads. A wait queue, you know, just a list of threads that you know we want to wake up later on. So the spin lock, we're going to acquire the spin lock whenever we manipulate anything else in the struct. So that's how we're going to keep our wait queue from like getting confused. Like if it's a linked list, we don't want to get confused about what's next, what's the head. We're going to acquire the lock to make sure we don't have to worry about that. And when lock taken, we're going to first acquire the spin lock before we update whether the lock is taken or not. So you don't have to worry about reading that the lock is taken and then assuming we can keep going and finding out that someone else sought the same thing. Okay. So we have this list of threads. All these threads are not runnable. That's important. So they're not runnable while they're in the queue. When we take them out of the queue, we're going to make them runnable again. So here's our basic code. When we lock, we say, OK, we get the guard mutex, and we say, is the lock taken? If it's taken, then I'm going to say, put myself on the wait queue. And then make me not runnable, so like an XV6, set my state to sleeping. Then release the spin lock, run the scheduler, switch to another thread. And later on, when we unlock the lock, instead of just setting this lock taken flag to zero, we're going to say, we're going to acquire the guard spin lock, and then we're going to say, is the wait queue empty right now? And we know no one's changing it because we have that guard lock, guard spin lock. And if so, we're going to remove a thread, make it runnable. Later on, when the scheduler eventually runs, that thread's going to finish and actually keep going. Note that there's a bit of a subtlety here. So one thing that's important is we need to worry about what happens here. Let's say the scheduler manages to run right here. It's possible, first of all, that this code here will run in this gap of time. So we need to make sure that that doesn't happen. In a bad way. And the bad thing which could happen is let's say we make ourselves, this thread becomes runnable, then that queue code runs, and then the scheduler runs. Then the scheduler would be trying to schedule a thread which is currently running. And that would be pretty bad. So the XV6 solution to this is that we would acquire the ptable lock before we'd acquire the ptable lock here, and we'd hold the ptable lock for this whole time. And that would solve that problem. We'd keep the scheduler from running until we keep the scheduler from running while we set our state to sleeping, you know, and keep someone else from making us run until we actually switch away from our current process. Another example solution is you might have separate tracking of whether you're sleeping and whether you're running on a CPU. This is what Linux does. Linux has a separate variable in the in their struct proc saying, is this on a CPU right now, from is this thread sleeping or runnable? But you need some solution to make sure that doesn't happen in this little window of time. So this idea makes sense, this lock implementation. So one observation I'd like you to make about this is that in the case where we don't have contention, where there's only one person using the lock at a time, where there's no waiting, this is basically the same as a spin lock. We acquire the spin lock, we set lock taken to true, then we acquire the spin lock, set lock taken to false. So it's actually really efficient in the case where we don't have contention. The only problem is if we do, we're doing something a lot more complicated. We're like adding to queues, running the scheduler, being very careful to sync up with the scheduler so nothing bad happens in that little window of time when the guard mutex is unlocked, and so on. So, and this is what our common mutexes do. Is that they have this sort of queue internally somewhere. We need operating system support because the scheduler needs to know about this. And like on Linux, there is operating system support. We may or may not talk about it later in the semester. To like do the put on myself in the wait queue operation. And this is what our pthread mutex actually does. So it does that sort of lock. It has this little spin lock. So in the common case, it just acquires the spin lock, sets a flag, gets rid of it. In the uncommon case, it acquires the spin lock and says, oh, it's already locked. I'm going to do this wait queue thing. Any questions about this? So these are our efficient locks, which we built up from our inefficient spin locks, which had a convenient hardware implementation using this modified state, because we had a way of having our cache be the only one with a value. And from that, we built up locks where we actually wait by letting other things happen, rather than cogging an entire core the entire time. So I'd like to briefly note, so this is our summary of pthread mutexes. There's some additional things that I'd like you to know exist. You can look up the documentation. You might want to use them. So the mutex attributes, one of the things they allow is they have this thing called error checking mutexes. And if you turn that on, lock and unlock will sometimes return errors when you do things like lock a mutex twice, or unlock an already unlocked mutex. If you don't do that, that's going to silently do something weird. It might do what you want. It might do something really weird. Also, we'll talk later about that there's an option to share mutexes between processes. One thing I'd like to note about mutexes that you can't do is the rule is that when you lock a mutex, you have to unlock it from the same thread you locked it in. Now, you don't have much reason to do this yet, but there's actually cases where it would be really convenient if this restriction didn't exist. But it does. And it's a kind of a puzzling restriction, because with the implementation I just showed you, it's not actually a problem. But there are other ways of implementing mutexes where, for example, instead of having a lock taken boolean, you might have a which thread has the lock variable. And that's something that some pthread mutexes might be implemented with, and that's why this restriction exists. Okay. So, questions about this? Okay, so, one question. So we saw locks. Locks are great. We saw how to implement locks like actually efficiently for various definitions of efficient, like minimal messages on the bus, actually waiting, using the CPU. Are they enough? Do we need more? Are there things we want to do with multiple threads that we can't do with locks? Anything you can think of. And we've, in fact, seen some things that you can't really do with locks. You've used it in an assignment. Something that you can't implement with just locks. Like, you know, like a mutex that we show. Like, what sort of operation can't we do? We've also seen some things we want to do in lecture that can't, it's hard to figure out how to implement with locks. It involves multiple threads. Any ideas? Things you want to do to talk, communicate between threads that seem hard to do with locks? Yeah?
Forking?
Forking?
Yeah.
What about forking?
Parent and child.
They have to what?
Communicating with each other.
Yeah, so what do you want to do when you communicate between a parent and child? What are some ways we've communicated?
You have to copy over all the process.
Okay, so that's how fork is implemented. But you're right, the idea is communicating between the parent and child. So fork, like we're just doing one thing in a thread to copy. That's okay. But there are parts of this process which are really problematic to do with just locks. And there is something you've done, yeah, or? Wait. So one of the things we did is wait. Implementing wait with locks, not really something we can do. And similarly, implementing join with locks, not really something we can do. We saw pthread join. It's not clear how to implement that with locks. Like, locks are bad for waiting for things. And we've seen another example of this. Was pipes. Pipes, the read waits for you to write. We don't have a good way of implementing that with locks. You can acquire a lock and send out, nothing's been written yet, but that's not what you want to do. You want to wait for someone to write. So we need some way to wait for other threads to finish. So we're going to introduce a bunch of extensions of locks that will help with this. And they're going to be barriers, counting semaphores, and condition variables, are the three we're going to talk about. And we're definitely going to talk about barriers next time because they're on the life assignment. And they're also the simplest one of these. And counting semaphores and condition variables are the most generally useful one of these. You can do pretty much anything you can imagine coordinating between threads with counting semaphores or with condition variables and locks. And these are all implemented using the things we've seen before with read, modify, write instructions, and queues of waiting threads. That single concept lets us implement all these sorts of primitives and many more we're not going to talk about. So we've seen all the building blocks. We just need to put them together in different ways to get things like wait for a thread to finish. So I'm going to start in 2 minutes. I'm going to briefly introduce barriers and we'll come to it, finish it up next time. Barriers, as I said, are the simplest of these. They're really simple and they're designed for this use case where we want to do parallel processing. We have a bunch of threads doing basically the same thing. So for example, let's say we have a 100 million element array. I want to sum it up. I have two cores. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make two threads. One thread's going to sum up the first 50 million. The other thread's going to sum up the other 50 million. Then we're going to have them wait for each other to finish. And then we're going to sum up the two sums in, say, the first thread. And this is a really convenient operation in general, waiting for all the threads to finish something when you're doing parallel computation like this. That the common thing you want to do is they all do basically the same thing. They all wait for everyone to finish. And then they do another round of basically the same thing. This is really common in simulations, for example, where everyone like simulates a part of the world, and then they do the next step where they look at all the previous simulation results and simulate the part of the world for the next set of time, and so on. It's a really handy pattern, and barriers are a primitive that implements this wait for everyone to finish operation. And the API is going to be like this, that we're going to have an initialize operation, where we specify the number of threads we run, and we're going to have a wait operation, And when you call wait, it waits for all the other threads to have called wait before it returns. So the pattern is everyone does something, they all call wait, then they do the next step, and only after everyone's finished the first step. So that's barriers. As I said, relatively simple. I'll go over some examples to give a more concrete idea next time. That's one thing you're going to use for the life assignment. Pthreads has a barrier type, which implements this itself. Okay, so that's all I have for today. I'll see you next time.